How is it that we find ourselves surrounded by such complexity, such elegance?
The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.
Listening to DNA Today, a genetics podcast and radio show. I'm your host, Kira Deneen. DNA Today informs you on what's happening in the genetic world. During my broadcast, I educate the public on genetic and health topics through event coverage, news stories, book movie reviews, and interviews. Guests include genetic counselors, researchers, patient advocates, and professors in the field of genetics. Today, my guest is Ginger Nichols, who is a certified genetic counselor. She currently works for Mother to Baby Connecticut, which is housed at UConn Health in the Human Genetics Department. Previously, she worked in the cytogenetic laboratory, taught undergraduate bio and genetic classes, counseled adults with Down syndrome and other genetic disorders. She received her bachelor's in bio and biology and sociology at Juniata College, followed by a master's in medical genetics at the University of Cincinnati. Quite impressive. Thank you for joining me today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
So let's talk a little bit about genetic counseling and what it is for those that don't know and what it offers patients.
So when I talk about genetic counseling, I tend to talk about, you're meeting with someone who specializes in genetics background for medicine, and it can be in different areas. So sometimes counselors can work in all areas, but sometimes they focus more on cancer or prenatal or pediatrics. And when you meet with them, I talk about it being a session where it comes down to informed consent or really breaking down some complicated information in a way that you can understand and use that information to make testing decisions or lifestyle changes or pregnancy management issues in a way that works in your own cultural beliefs and your own personal style where you make choose your medicine and health care.
And it's definitely an important skill to have to be able to translate that knowledge. You're basically a translator when it comes to that dense genetic knowledge to saying, in layman's terms, what it means, maybe bring it down to high school level or, you know, college education level of people that are non-science folks, right?
Right. So we want to be able to talk to people at whatever level they're comfortable talking about it. And I think that's a good skill for genetic counselors, that they're usually able to take it, research, and bring it to a room and just sit down and talk about it where we can all understand it.
And you mentioned there's a lot of different areas of genetic counseling, one of them being prenatal that you're involved in. Tell us about Mother to Baby, that where you're a genetic counselor. Like, what does the organization provide the public and specifically pregnant women?
So Mother to Baby Connecticut is housed at UConn Health Center, and we are a free phone service. You also can reach us by email if you have questions. We're available to talk about exposures during your pregnancy or breastfeeding. So medicines, whether it's your prescription medicine over the counter, or if you have questions about alcohol or cigarettes, other recreational drugs, or exposures at your workplace, so occupational exposures or environmental exposures, we research the literature that's on it and then go over that with you. And our hope is to help make people learn about risk-benefit versus staying on their medicines, or how we can help get rid of some exposures or reduce exposures in your workplace as well.
So as a genetic counselor, you're kind of that person talking to the patients directly. Is that your role?
Yes. So my position there, I get intake when people call or email us. I research the question that they have about their medicine exposure or occupational environmental exposure. And then I go back with them usually it's over the phone, and explain what I found in the literature and, again, break it down into that kind of informed consent session where I'm making it available to them so they can understand it and use it in their pregnancy.
So what is the suggestion for pregnant or nursing women? Because you're also talking about women who are breastfeeding. What is the suggestion for those medications that you mentioned? Say they're taking Prozac for depression, or you can name it by its generic term.
So yeah, you're right. Prozac is a common term for a drug called fluoxetine. And really the literature that's out there on it right now, we don't think it would increase the risk for birth defects. It's been pretty well studied. And what we've learned is that untreated depression in pregnancy can actually cause pregnancy complications itself. And so oftentimes staying on your medicine, if it's working for you, is really the right way to go to treat your depression during pregnancy. And for women who have depression, and then come off their medicines during pregnancy, sometimes they can go through a relapse and into a severe depressed state. So they're not able to take care of themselves, eat, sleep. That's all off. So, and then they're also sometimes at higher risk for a postpartum depression. So after the baby's born and you go through that huge hormone crash. So I guess, you know, if you, I should have said it before, if you want to call us in Connecticut, it's 860-679-6199 is Mother to Baby Connecticut, or you can email us. And
I can throw it in the show notes for the email address. And October is Pregnancy and Infant Loss Awareness Month, and you mentioned that depression is something that is associated with sometimes after pregnancy, and also PTSD. So where do we kind of see this coming into play? Is this common? Is it not common? Women that have this, what would you say to them for kind of advice and that kind of thing?
So what, unfortunately, and my heart goes out to anyone who's listening who's ever had a pregnancy loss, because it's a terrible thing to go through. And working in my job in prenatal genetic counseling, I know that it happens a lot. So we're either talking about miscarriages or losing the baby soon after birth or later in a pregnancy with a stillbirth. Those women, the studies have shown, are at much higher risk to develop depression and post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, in their future pregnancy. So getting pregnant again then raises a lot of these emotional issues, these fears and guilt about things happening again during their pregnancy and losing another pregnancy. So as a genetic counselor, I often sit and talk with these women and talk about these fears that they're facing, and we encourage a lot of strong support group. It doesn't always have to be medicine either. So sometimes it's just yoga or having a good friend to talk to, or your doctors. Finding a supportive OBGYN in your future pregnancy is always useful.
I think a great thing about genetic counselors, from what I've seen of job shadowing and things, is that you have time with a genetic counselor versus doctors that have a tighter schedule, having to see a lot of patients in one day. Genetic counselors can take a little more time to sit with those patients and just talk about their emotions, and that's kind of the counseling aspect of the profession, and such a great resource for people that are in this position and understandably going through these really hard times, and for them to be able to talk to someone that also knows the science behind it and kind of compare that with the emotions is an awesome resource to really take advantage of.
Yeah, I think you make a great point. genetic counselors do have more time to sit and actually talk with the people who are coming in to talk with them, versus I know my OBGYN kind of has 15-minute time slot scheduled. Although I did find one who, you know, was open to, if I wanted to ask questions, let me sit and talk to him as well. So it's important to have trust in your healthcare provider as well.
So over the last year, we've heard a lot about Zika virus, and this has been a big fear for the public, but especially pregnant women, as we've heard of microcephaly happening in pregnancies. What kind of is your advice, or what have you learned from what's out there in the media? Because we're hearing a lot of different things, but as an expert, what can you kind of share on this topic?
So we are still learning a lot about the Zika virus during pregnancy, but we do, and so what we don't know yet is it more dangerous to, if you develop Zika in your pregnancy, to get it early in the pregnancy versus late in the pregnancy? And right now we kind of think that there doesn't matter, but it could affect the severity of symptoms. And most people who are exposed to a mosquito or who get Zika, I think it's 1 out of 5 people will show symptoms. So not everyone has symptoms. So that's the scary part of it. It can affect, what we know now is the central nervous system in the developing baby, so it can affect the brain development of the brain. So like you said, microcephaly.
Which means they have a very small head, small.
Exactly, a small head. And then microencephaly, the other word you're talking about, so it's actually stopping the brain development, and then the brain actually is, and I know it sounds sad, but it's collapsing back on itself. So, and not all babies can be born with microcephaly that they pick up right away, that maybe they'll go on to develop some seizures. So it, of course, anyone hearing that, that's a scary,
very scary,
scary topic. And really during pregnancy, they're can follow with ultrasounds to check, the growth of the baby and the size of the head. But there is testing now becoming available to test to see if you have Zika. Because as I said before, not everyone who gets Zika virus will actually have symptoms to know that you're affected.
So if it's found that a pregnant woman is positive for the Zika virus, is there intervention to do, or is it more just being aware of what's going to happen and educating the woman on the possible outcomes?
Right. There's nothing we could really do for intervention-wise. It would be following the pregnancy to watch to see if any symptoms show up on ultrasounds.
Another thing that is kind of recent in the news is it's time to get flu shots. I'm signed up to get my flu shot in a couple of weeks here. Is it recommended for pregnant women to get a flu shot? Is that a positive thing? Can there be consequences? Kind of what's the recommendation there?
Yes, that's a good point. We want everyone who is pregnant to get their flu shot during flu season.
So that is a strong yes, it sounds like.
Yes, strong yes. It's been well studied in pregnancy. And so actually what we would say is don't do the nasal spray. But this year, actually, they're saying no one should do the nasal spray for their flu shot. But
so the nasal spray, for those that kind of just hear like, oh, that sounds painless, I'll do that. That's actually a live version of the virus that's a little bit broken down from what I understand.
Right, good, yeah.
Okay. And then the normal shot is just the dead virus, right, kind of dead, right, alive, or yeah, kind of loose terms there. But
yeah, so the vaccine that's the shot form is, the virus is not alive, so you're not going to develop symptoms. You're not going to get sick from the shot. So we would recommend that in any pregnancy, definitely. When you're pregnant, your immune system drops, so you're more susceptible to having severe symptoms of the flu. So it's one of the reasons why they want you to have the flu shot when you're pregnant.
And not only, I imagine, is it bad for the pregnant woman to have it just coming down with the flu, probably its effects on the fetus. Is that right?
So really, it's unlikely that flu itself would really cause a problem for the pregnancy unless you had very high fevers for many days in a row very early in your pregnancy. Otherwise, it's just, as you can imagine, if you're pregnant, especially early in pregnancy, you're not feeling well. If you have your so-called morning sickness, I say so-called because it's not just the morning usually.
All day.
excuse me. So it's not fun to feel achy and sick on top of being pregnant. It's not fun at any time. But so what they would often do in pregnancy with flu, you want to treat your fevers. And sometimes if you get to your doctor soon enough, they'll talk to you about some of the antiviral medicines to try to shorten the amount of time you're fighting off the infection. But like, as I said before, sometimes when you're pregnant, you are more at risk to developing more severe symptoms. And so pregnant women who develop the flu are a little bit more likely to be hospitalized because of the flu versus just people in the general population who aren't pregnant.
And then if you're hospitalized, you're exposed to much more just being in a hospital setting.
Right.
As a genetic counselor for mother-to-baby, obviously you're increasing awareness of the resources that you guys provide. How do you express to the public that there are those resources? How do you increase the public's awareness for?
Well, I think so. For Mother to Baby Connecticut, we're part of a national organization called Mother to Baby, and we're under the umbrella of a group called Otis. So we're in Connecticut. You might associate Otis with Elevator Company, but we're actually, so it stands for Organization of Teratogen Information Specialists. And we have a national website called mothertobaby.org, and there are, for people who are looking for information on fact sheets or information on medicines and exposure, we have some fact sheets up on that website that are available free.
And there's
to
a
anyone.
Lot of them. They're awesome. I looked through a couple of them, and it's very,
hear.
Yeah, it's really organized too, and it's easy to get to what you're looking for.
That's good to hear, yeah. So that's, but, and then Mother to Baby Connecticut, we have a Facebook page, and at the health center, you can look us up on the website at UConn Health under the Mother to Baby Connecticut. For genetic counselors in general, to get the national organization called the National Society of Genetic Counselors, or NSGC for short, is a great place to go for genetic counselors who are looking for more information. Or if you want to speak with a genetic counselor, you can go to their website, and I think there's a link there that says find a genetic counselor, which will help you find one close to where you are.
And if there's no one close to you, you can find someone that does phone sessions,
yeah,
which is
point.
Great. So we cover everybody in
right.
the area. So for students that are interested in becoming a genetic counselor that are like, you know what, this sounds really interesting, I think I want to pursue this, whether it be prenatal or cardiac or cancer, many, many different fields. That's just, tip of the iceberg there. What would you say that are really good aspects to have on your application? How can someone make their application for genetic counseling schools, that is, to be really strong and say, I really think I'm going to get in because I have this on here? What would you say are those top aspects?
Most programs are looking for kind of similar background courses in the sciences, but you can come into the field of genetic counseling really from any field. So it doesn't have to be in biology. So people who've gone through school for education or social work. I know someone who was an actor who came back to school to do genetic counseling. What I think program directors look for in you, they do look to see if you have a good, strong career of good grades, because they want to see that you're going to be able to succeed. They only take about 6 to 12 students per program, so they want to only accept students that they can see making it.
And that's
it
with
through.
Hundreds applying typically for every school for those 6 to 12 positions generally.
Right.
So
that,
you're talking about high stakes.
Yeah. So, and I could say too, I didn't get in my first year that I applied to genetic counseling program, so I had to reapply. And when I talked to the program directors that year, when I got my rejection letter, they said my GRE scores were a little bit low, and I retook them and got back in. So right now I think that there are things that they look at. So GREs, your GPA average. But one of the biggest thing I think that makes you look strong is, we call it shadowing experiences, but just how can you demonstrate to the people who are enrolling the students that I've thought a lot about this career. I'm very excited about it. And I can see myself enrolling in your program, and this is the job I want to do. And so, I mean, for you, like doing these podcasts, to, you know, I would think that that would be a great thing on an application. But finding a genetic counselor, if you can, to shadow them during the clinic time or at a lab, those things look good in your...
And even if you can't shadow, because sometimes there's HIPAA laws and things that can kind of get in the way of being able to shadow, just interviewing like I am right now, just talking to a genetic counselor, and kind of picking their brain and saying, what do you like about it? What do you hate about it? Because that's always a good question, you know.
Yeah.
If what they hate about it you can live with, then that might be a good job for you.
Right, yeah. Yeah, you're right. It does. I think it is getting harder for genetic counselors or students who want to be genetic counselors to find those shadowing experiences, because it's starting, like you said, the training you have to go through to prove your the HIPAA, so that's the Privacy Act, to make sure, you know, the patients that are being seen with the genetic counselors can feel comfortable having a student room with them. It gets hard and there's a lot of paperwork, so there are other ways. And I think this is a creative, really neat way to
thanks, also, yeah. And I think it's great, even if you can't talk to one, by listening to, you know, episodes like I produce, or there's lots of videos online that you can actually watch kind of mock genetic counseling sessions with different genetic counselors talking with, you know, a pseudo patient, I guess you could call them.
That's true. Good points.
Yeah. So there's definitely lots of resources out there. So, all right, now we've convinced them they're doing genetic counseling.
Right. Everyone should be a genetic counselor.
Yes. So now that they've decided that this is what they want to pursue, they've found their, you know, life goal here, they start looking at schools. What are some aspects of schools that they should look at? What are different things about programs that you can really point out and say, you know, off the top of my head, like class size? Some programs are 6 kids, while one of the biggest programs in our country is, you know, 25 or 22, around that.
Right.
What are some other things that students should consider when starting to look at all the schools?
So all the programs that are open to be genetic counseling training programs have to be accredited by the Accreditation Council for Genetic Counseling. And so most programs will feel similar in some respects in regards to what is the coursework that they have to show that they're training their students in. But I think questions to ask, when I was interviewing, I definitely got a sense of, well, gee, this program seems to be very heavily science-based, information-based, and maybe this program is much more counseling skills-based. You want to ask questions about what kind of project the student has to do. You know, was it a thesis project, a capstone project? They tend to have different a feel to what they expect their students to look at as well. I think in the future, you know, a big growing field of genetic counseling, while all areas still is a high job demand, but cancer genetic counseling and laboratory genetic counseling are really rapidly growing. All programs need to train to prove to be accredited to train that they're training their students in all areas of genetic counseling. So that would be available at any program. But if you have a special focus, you might want to see with the program you're looking at what their clinical training sites look like and how often you can get into maybe the field you're particularly interested in if you know already what you might want to do.
So as you mentioned before, genetic counseling is total rapidly expanding field. It's NSGC recently had their conference, highest attended one ever, that was in Seattle just this past month. And there's just such a high job demand. In Connecticut, it's definitely in the top 5 or 10. I can't remember the stat now, but it's definitely in the top 10 of the most rapidly growing jobs. So it's a huge, rapidly expanding field, not just in Connecticut, the country. Where do you see the future heading? You mentioned kind of cancer is really exploding in laboratory. Are there other areas of genetic counseling or just different technologies or different types of testing that we're using that are really starting to grow and kind of become a major part of the field, whereas before it was kind of maybe newer technology?
It's definitely like, so with the whole, you know, genome-wide sequencing and exome sequencing that's going on, technology is actually moving very quickly. And so we're, as a genetic counselor, we're constantly learning about new tests and what we can actually test for. It's much, we can actually look for many more things than we did when I first started being a genetic counselor back in 2000. So it's moving quickly. I'm not sure I'm really answering your question. There is definitely a job demand, and that's being driven by this lab-based technology that's moving very quickly and what we're able to look at in our genetics and genomics. And I think it's an exciting time to be in the field.
Definitely. And for those that kind of are unsure of like what a lab genetic counselor would be, kind of can you give us a snapshot of what that looks like, what their kind of daily life is like?
So I actually haven't worked in a laboratory, but I do know in talking to other genetic counselors that work in a lab, a lot of what they do is they work on helping to create reports that go out to the doctors that, or straight to patients, that are understandable and that are usable. And they also will answer the phone and talk to the doctors who are ordering the test who have questions about just ordering the test or when they get the results, how do I take this result you just gave me now and actually explain it to my patient? Or sometimes they will talk directly to the patient. Sometimes labs are hiring genetic counselors. You talked before about having genetic counseling available by phone. Some labs have the genetic counselors there who are available to talk to the patients directly about what their test result means. And then there's also a piece of it where you might be asked to represent a certain area, and if a doctor wants to, you know, or an office or a hospital wants to learn more about your lab specific testing technology, you might go out and give presentations on the lab-based part of your test and why it's appropriate for their patients, etc. So
just shows how many jobs there are. As we've kind of hinted at before, that the non-traditional genetic counselor jobs are becoming more traditional.
Exactly.
Every day.
Exactly.
That, you know, having your own business, private practice are all options within genetic counseling. And if you find something that's not there, it means you can just create yourself kind of a niche in there.
Right.
So I kind of want to end with how you got into genetics, genetic counseling, how you got inspired, found out about the field. What's your background? How did you get into this?
So mine is, I think, a little bit of a fun story. I knew I loved science. And I was a high school senior and, you know, in the science club and really got along with my high school biology teacher. And he and his wife were trying to get pregnant. And he went to see a genetic counselor. They, as a couple, went to see a genetic counselor. And he came back and he said to me, Ginger, I found the perfect job for you. And it was the first time I heard about genetic counselors. And the more I looked at it, I said, you know what, he's right, this is it, because I wanted to be in the science field. I love learning new things. I didn't want to be just in a laboratory. I wanted to work with people, but I didn't really see myself going to be a doctor. It felt a little too overwhelming of a job for me, and this was a nice fit because there was people interaction, but always a chance to learn.
Definitely, and finding out in high school is definitely very early. Most people find out later in life.
Yeah.
Or do a career change because they find that's what I'm actually looking for, kind of thing. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today and just kind of talking with us about prenatal genetic counseling and also just different options for school and what people should consider if they want to end up being a genetic counselor. People can visit mothertobaby.org for more information. We mentioned that before. And do you want to repeat the number you said before?
860-679-6199.
Awesome. So give them a call there if you're looking for more information. And if you want to find a genetic counselor in your area, like we described before, there's the Find a Genetic Counselor feature on nsgc.org. Again, if there's not one in your area, there's always phone sessions available. Another cool tool that you can use is something, a new website from NSGC, aboutgeneticcounselors.org. That is awesome for students and also for the public if they're looking about more information before going into a genetic counseling session, how they should prepare, and all that. So you can check out dnapodcast.com, at dnapodcast on Twitter. And any questions for the two of us, me or Ginger, info@dnapodcast.com. I can send them along to her because she can answer all those way better than I can. So again, thank you for coming on the show. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. I think it's really neat what you're doing, so thank you.
Thanks. Thanks for listening, guys, and join me next week to learn and discover new advances in the world of genetics.
The genes of you and me,
the genes of you and me,
we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.